All right. Well, good morning. This weekend is when we celebrate both Sanctity of Life Sunday, but also Martin Luther King. And the reality of what Martin Luther King and the Civil Rights Movement meant to this nation is really important. We don't want to let that die. And so Kid President was a nice way for us to be able to say, hey, let's not forget this, and let's move forward with it. In fact, we feel like one of the issues of the sanctity of life itself is the reality that we're all made different, sometimes different hues and colors, hues and colors and shades, and you know, it's kind of all over the map, right? And it was God's idea. It was God's idea. And when we demean God's idea, we demean God himself. And really, it's part of the underlying issues of this whole sanctity of life issue is when we demean what God has done, we demean him himself. And that which he created. And so in a few weeks from now, we're going to talk about the unborn. In a week after that, the first week in February, we're going to talk about race and the sanctity of race and what that's all about. Very touchy, not an easy issue in our day. But we need to talk about it. So we're going to talk about it in a few weeks. But today, we've been talking about life this whole month. We're going to talk about it. And in fact, we've been talking about love, trying to ask the question, what does it look like to love, really? Deep down, and I'm pretty convinced that the more we ask the question, the more difficult it's going to get. When we really ask and get down deeper into who we are, that the answers are going to be harder, and that it's going to push us to places that are very difficult. And sometimes then I think, well, maybe we ought to just change the question. Okay, let's ask an easier question, okay? But I think maybe we need to stick with this question. So talking a lot about life, and we're talking a lot about love. If you put them together, you either get love life or love life, and that's what we're going to talk about this month, is really loving life. And so today, like we said, is the Sanctity of Life Sunday that we're celebrating across the nation. But we're not going to recognize it quite the same way that a lot of people are. All of January is going to be the Sanctity of Life Month. In fact, we're going to go into February with it. And then this Sanctity of Life Month, last week we talked about the foundation, and we'll talk a little bit more about that today. But then next week, we're going to talk about the sanctity of life of the elderly. That in a nation that has begun to push them away and push them into an invisible place, the value of the elderly. And the closer I get to that, the more I think we need to talk about it. And the following week after that, we're going to talk about the unborn. And some of the issues that go on in our culture with that. But today, in the Sanctity of Life Month, I want to talk about the infirm. When I talk about the infirm, in fact, we've used this quote from Hubert Humphrey. I think it's a really good one to go back and even review. It says this, that the moral test of government, and let's circle government here for a second, that the moral test of government is how that government treats three sets of people. Those who are in the dawn of life, that's the children, those who are in the twilight of life, the elderly, those who are in the shadows of life, the sick, the needy, and the handicapped. In our culture, we call that disabled now. And that's probably going to be the biggest focus that I have today is talking about the disabled. Now, talking about the sick and the needy is just as important. But for today, I'm going to talk a little bit more about the disabled. But it seems to me that the moral test of our government is also the moral test of our society. Because our government is simply the people we elected. We chose them. We asked them to represent us and to then do what we asked them to do in our government. It's a republic. It's a representative government, right? And so they simply do what we ask them to do. And so we then have to ask about our society and what it's doing. But really, at the end of the day, maybe the most important is we've got to ask about the church. It is the moral test of the church, that church treats those who are in the dawn of life, the children, those who are in the twilight of life, the elderly, and those who are in the shadows of life. How do we treat them? How do we as a church stand up to that? It's really the most important question. And so today we're going to talk about that bottom section. Let's circle it, that those who are in the shadows of life. I love the way that that's put. That feels like it's right. Those who are put away into the shadows of life, the sick and the needy, and the disabled, the handicapped. What do we do with them? And how ought we to deal with them? And so as we talk about the infirm here, and we talk about the value of life, we really have to come back to God's design. If there's any basis for any of this, it has to be in who God is and what he designed and what he required and what he wanted. And so if we go back to even the passage that we looked at last week in Genesis 1, this verse 27 is really kind of that core, clear, and very simple expression that so God created man in his image. We are image bearers of God. We carry some similarity to who he is in who we are. Now, we're not omnipotent, we're not all-powerful, we're not all-knowing, we're not all-present, so we're not like God in those ways. We're limited. What we are like him is in our the ability to have, make choices, the ability to make decisions, the ability to have morality, the ability to love deeply like he does, to be able to express that. He breathed into us life like nothing else in all of creation. That's what makes us different. And it's clear as a bell that we are. And we need to take that responsibility rather than abdicating that responsibility and saying, well, I'm really no more important than my dog. Now, my dog is important. I don't have one anymore. We did. Used to have one. But Tucker went on to doggy heaven, or I don't know if there's doggy heaven, but he's gone, right? But he's important, but he's not like mankind. Now, I love that dog. It was totally fun. But he created man in his image, and I love this. In the image of God, he created him, wanting for emphasis to say it again. And then the uniqueness we talked about last week is he created us, and this is God's idea, and this is very clearly expressed. Male and female, he created them. He wanted us to know from the very beginning of the uniqueness of his creative hand in making guys and gals, men and women, male and female. And when we demean that, we demean God. And when we demean that, we demean each other rather than celebrating each other. Wow. So that we are made in the image of God. And so really where we landed last week was with these five things. First of all is this, Imago Dei. It's Latin for the image of God. And that defines us, that we were created in his image. We carry it. Imago Dei. So that's just maybe a Latin word. If you don't know Latin, you can grab onto that one. The Imago Dei. Secondly, that life is expressed uniquely as male and female. That is an amazing deal. That's really cool. That's worth celebrating. Third is that we were made to multiply, to thrive, to produce, and to invest, I think. So for singles to say, well, wait a second, I can't, you know, I'm not supposed to be having kids right now. But that's not just it. It's investing who God has made us in the lives of other people. And you know, she would hate me for saying this, so I'm going to say it anyway. But Kim Underwood has invested in the lives of young women for years and made a huge difference in their lives. It's huge. I can't even describe it, of how valuable what she's done in the lives of all these girls that were in junior high school, now college and beyond, and all the places that they've gone and all the things that they've done in the investment, the difference that she's made. I think it's amazing. So it's not just procreation. It's investing who you are. Right? The next one is that we're to subdue, to exercise responsibility. That's what he gave us, to exercise responsibility in this world. It's amazing. We're responsible for this thing, to do it well. And sometimes we've done it so well, and other times we've done it so poorly. So poorly. But, and last but not least, that mankind is identified as very good. At the pinnacle of creation, it is mankind. That is the pinnacle of that. And God said, wow. He just stepped back after 6 days of creating. And he said, man, that is so good. That's awesome. I'm going to take a break for a day and enjoy it. That's what he kind of said. He wasn't tired. God doesn't get tired. He didn't need a sabbatical. He didn't need a Sabbath because he was beat tired. He just said, it's enough. It's enough. I'm satisfied. That's what a sabbatical for us is be able to say, it's enough, I'm satisfied. I don't need to work another day, I'm going to take it off. It's enough. God, I'm going to trust you with it. And he said, wow, it's enough. That's incredible. And it was identified as very good. Now, mankind, men and women, we are at this point in human history are what I call a broken glory. We're glorious, made in the image of God, but we're broken, right? And so we go, how do we deal with that? And so what I want to do today as we talk about the infirm, I want to go to a passage, and it seemed like to me maybe a better way to go is to begin to say, how did Jesus deal with this? What did Jesus have to say about this? Let's look in, rather than kind of doing a systematic theology of the entire scriptures on this, I think maybe Jesus brings out the issue in the way he lived out his life, the way he treated people, the way he engaged them. And so I chose John chapter 9, verses 1 through 7, and we're going to look at this passage and say, okay, how did he deal with this? Did it come up? And how did he relate to it? So let's open up that passage here. Verse 1. It says, as he passed by, let's stop there just for a second. As he passed by, now here's the deal. He had been interacting with those Jewish leaders in Jerusalem and in other places, but he had really begun to say, identify who he was. And he identifies himself in chapter 8 as the light of the world. And they began to understand that what Jesus was saying is that he was more than Abraham. And for the Jew, that was really hard to hear. They're saying, whoa, 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 wait a second. You're putting yourself above Abraham? Like, Abraham's at the top of the ladder here for us, big fella. You're saying you're above him? And Jesus says, yeah, that's what I'm telling you. In fact, I am the Christ. I am the light of the world. And they begin to get a little bugged with him. And in fact, they're so bugged with him that they decide they want to arrest him and probably kill him. And so he then leaves that place at that time. But sometimes we picture Jesus maybe running away like a scared little boy. And he didn't at all. In fact, it says, as he passed by, as soon as he left there, he simply left in a dignified fashion. And as he's passing, he didn't run. And in fact, when he saw someone in need, he stopped right there. He could have been arrested. He could have been grabbed. But he had something real important to do. And so he stops here. He says, as he passed by, he saw a man blind from birth, a disabled man, blind from the very beginning, born blind. And it says, and his disciples asked him. And so they get inquisitive here. And they ask him, hey, Rabbi, not really realizing he's the Christ yet, the Messiah. But they say, hey, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? A reasonable question, because they saw that any evil had to be someone's responsibility. That's kind of their mindset. It had to be someone's responsibility. And so this man is born blind, and they say, who is it that sinned, his parents or him? Something that he did in the womb must have been so inappropriate that he's born blind. And so they're going to, what did he do there? Or what did his parents do before he was born this would be the punishment? Well, what's that all about? And tell you the truth, that's not too much different than sometimes what people talk about today. And so Jesus answers in verse 3, and he says this. It is not that this man sinned or his parents, but that the works of God might be displayed in him. And you think, okay, well, wait a second. So they stopped and said, okay, this doesn't fit what we expected. We thought it would either be the boy's fault or the parents' fault. And you're saying, no, it's none of that. But it's so that God's power might be expressed, that the works of God might be displayed in him. And I'm sure they were a bit confused. Didn't know exactly what to do with that. But somehow Jesus puts it on a better plane, right? He addresses it in a way to say, no, this is because God wants to display his redemptive love, his redemptive work. Yes, we live in a broken world, is what he's saying. That the impact of the fall in Genesis chapter 3 ruined everything. And it's played its way out in all sorts of things, even in birth disabilities, the brokenness of our own bodies. It's worked its way out in all sorts of unique and really difficult ways, right? But he's saying, but this happened so that the works of God, that God might enter in here and we see something unique and special. Wow. So look in verse 4. We must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. But night is coming when no one can work. He's saying, while there is still time to do, we ought to do what God has called us to do. There will be a day when day comes to an end and night comes and it's over. He's referring to the end of this age. But he says, but while there's something still to do, we ought to do it. And so he's saying it to them, to his disciples. We must do the works of God. Wow. Well, you go, in my mind, I start thinking, okay, well, wait a second, I'm all that, but I don't know if I can go up and make sure that every blind person is healed. I don't know if I can do that. I'm not sure exactly what he's saying. Now, he's going to do that here in a second. But I think we can see, what would it be to be redemptive? What would it be to do the works of God in a redemptive way in people's lives? Wow. So verse 5, he says, as long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world. Now, look in verse 6. Having said these things, he spit on the ground and made mud with the saliva, something that probably in schools today they wouldn't look highly upon. You know, it's not very cool. But Jesus spits on the ground, and he makes mud out of the saliva, and then he anoints the man's eyes with the mud, and he says to him, hey, go wash in the pool of Siloam, which means sent. And he went, and he washed, and he came back seeing. He asked him, now, would I do it this way? Ah, this is such a creative thing to do, right? So he's going to make mud, and he could have just healed him right there, right? He could have just said, hey, see. But he did it in this creative way to allow the man to respond in faith, to allow the man to trust God. And go, okay. And he goes down to the pool of Siloam. He washes it off and he sees. That must have been an amazing moment. Wouldn't you love to have been there to see the first time that he saw? That had to be stunning. I don't know if you saw the YouTube video not too long ago. Just a few days ago, I saw it of this little baby, or toddler. Yeah, it's kind of between a baby and a toddler. And they implanted a hearing device. And for the very first time, he heard his parents' voice. And you could tell it was shocking. He was like, he just stopped. He was like, whoa, what's going on here? And then there's this grin that kind of came over his face. Like, oh my gosh, I can hear. And the parents were elated because they could tell he could hear him for the very first time. I think that's probably a lot what it looked like here. You know, that for the very first time he saw. Wow. I'm not going to tell the rest of the story, but it goes on. Basically, he went around saying, I can see. And all of his neighbors were saying, are you the guy that used to not be able to see? Or are you a new guy? And he goes, no, I'm the old guy, you know, but I can see now. And then they get all fired up about it. And then the Jewish leaders come in and they get all fired up and they say, when did that happen? On the Sabbath? Well, yeah. Well, that shouldn't happen on the Sabbath. And they get all mad at Jesus about it. Seems crazy, right? And then it's just sort of this whole hullabaloo that goes on as a result of Jesus simply touching this disabled man and healing him. Wow. Now, but I think there's another passage that helps us in understanding some of this. Let's go to Exodus chapter 4, verses 10 through 17. Let's open that up. Here's a thought. So here's Moses. Let me put this in context. Exodus 4, Moses has gone up onto Mount Sinai, and he saw a burning bush, and he thought that was weird, and so he took off his shoes. Well, he didn't take off his shoes yet. He went over to see the burning bush, and God says, hey, this is holy ground. Take your shoes off. And he takes them off, and God speaks to him, and he says, hey, Moses, I want to use you in the lives of Israel. I know you left 40 years ago from Israel. You ran away when you killed somebody. I want you to come back. I'm going to send you back because I want you to help your people. And Moses was a little hesitant. And you can imagine, of course, we all would be, right? And so he's a little hesitant to go back, and he says, well, okay, if I go back and they ask me who sent me, what's your name? Yeah, like, who am I going to tell them sent me? And God says, you just tell them, the great I am sent you. The one who has been, is, and will always be. The great I am has sent you. Now, that would probably be a good enough call, right? I mean, like, okay, that's a big deal. All right, I think I'll do this. But look at this in verse 10. But Moses said to the Lord, oh, my Lord, I am not eloquent, either in the past or since you have spoken to my servant, but I am slow of speech and of tongue. He's like, okay, I don't speak Egyptian very well. It's been a long time since I spoke Egyptian. I'm not very good at it anymore. I don't speak very well anyway. I'm not very eloquent. So this big thing that you've asked me to do and you've told me why it's worth doing, it's because it's based on who you are. I don't know if I can do that. So I'm not very eloquent. So I don't know if I really want to do this, God. And so he says, and I wasn't good in the past, and I'm not even good now that you've spoken to me. It just, when I was reading this, it hit me that most of us kind of respond to God that way, just like Moses did. God, hey, I wasn't very good in the past. And now that I've heard your voice and you've done your redemptive work in me, I'm still not very good. I can't do this. Your love for me, your power in me, it's probably not enough. So I think I'll stay right where I am, right where I've always been. I'm not going to move out in faith. I think I'll just stay right here. I'm not very eloquent, never have been, never will be. No matter what you do in me, God, it's not going to matter. Your work is wasted in my life. I think I'll stay right here. That's what he's saying. We do the same thing, don't we? God, it's not enough. You are not enough. I need something else, something more. Well, it says, but I am slow of speech and of tongue. And so the Lord says to him, look at this in verse 11. Let's put a circle around this thing. But the Lord says to him, hey, Moses, have you forgotten who has made man's mouth? Have you forgotten? It's not about your mouth. It's about who made your mouth. He goes on and he says, who makes him mute or deaf or seeing or blind? Do you not understand that I am the sovereign God of the universe? So what has happened here is not beyond my understanding. It's not beyond my comprehension. And I understand what's happened. He says, is it not I, the Lord, who've done this? Now, before we go too much farther, there obviously is a theological struggle here. Is God the author of the disability? Did he design it? Did he decide it? Did he inflict it? Is this God who does evil, in a sense? We have to wrestle with that because it almost sounds like that here, right? Like, okay, I am the author of this. When you look at the scriptures as a whole, and this is where we have to look at it in the big picture, it seems to me that God is never the author of evil. We will never find God in his character being the author of what is wrong. But, in fact, here's how I want to describe it. There are three dimensions, I think, to God's will, of what God does. This has really helped me over the years, and hopefully it'll help us in this situation, that there are three dimensions to God's will. One is there his perfect will. He had a design for life. He had a design for you and for me. He had a design for Adam and Eve. It was a perfect and incredible will. It was awesome in every way. There was no death. There were no tears. There was nothing wrong. They walked in the garden with God. They enjoyed every moment of it. They didn't have to wear clothes. They didn't even know they were naked. It was just a great situation, right? And the whole world was this beautiful garden, and it had this water canopy around it, which makes it like a greenhouse effect. It was this beautiful place where it was just everything was perfect. And then Adam and Eve decided to take life into their own hands. And they decided they wanted to be like God and be his equal. And things have gone downhill ever since. And so his perfect will also has a permissive will to it. God in his kindness gave us free will to choose or to not choose to walk with him. But the implications, God said, is when you choose to do it your own way, the death enters into the world, the destruction of what it was supposed to be. And he permitted that to happen. It wasn't by his design, but it was what happened when we decided to do it our own way. And as a result, sin has damaged everything. Everything in life. It's affected everything. And as a result, we are all marred and broken. Now, in this culture, there is, and in the culture of the world, for those who are disabled, whether it be physically or mentally, that they seem to get identified as more broken than anybody else. It's not actually true. It's not really fair. We all have our brokenness, right? But they are identified as being able to be maybe considered lower than anybody else, maybe able to be excused more than anybody else. Let me read you an article from Christianity Today. It's just a short part of it, written by a gal named Dr. Deborah Coughlin. She's a psychologist therapist. And she's writing this article, and listen to this. It's incredible. She says, the disabled are better off dead. They suck up resources and contribute little to society. With limited medical personnel, medications, and money, why should these parasites be alive? Why not kill them? Shouldn't we consider the impact of keeping the disabled going? Why would it be acceptable to euthanize those with disabilities to decrease the surplus population? She goes on to write, that's not her feelings, but she writes this. These are the frightening words which I hear from more and more frequency, and they are absolutely sickening. You would think that such words would be met with disdain from the public. However, there is a growing support for this line of thought. Increasingly, there are articles and reports that vilify the disabled in the same way that serial killers objectify their victims. It is a growing movement around the world to have the disabled eliminated. And it's not a new idea. It's happened for thousands of years. The Nazis decided that they would not only kill Jews and kill homosexuals, but that they would take the disabled. And by the hundreds of thousands, they killed them. When the Nazis invaded Poland, within the first month, they killed 10,000 institutionalized disabled people. It is not new for the idea of eliminating the infirm. There is something so profoundly evil about that. And what I think God is saying here, let's go back to Exodus chapter 4, that I do have, I do have a perfect will which has been broken. I do have a permissive will, but I also have an ultimate will, that I will work all things together for good for those who know me and are called according to my purpose, who love me and are called according to what I do. I have something that I'm doing. And here he says, who has made man's mouth? Who makes him mute or deaf or seeing or blind? Is it not I, the Lord? I'm the one who can use this in someone's life. Wow. Go to verse 12. It says, now therefore go, and I will be with your mouth and teach you what to speak. I'll be with you. I'll be with you. Don't sweat it. And it seems to me at this point he should have said, man, you got it. That's right. Okay, I'm with you. But Moses doesn't do that. Look in verse 13. He says, but he said, oh my Lord, please send somebody else. Okay, you made it, but you're not, I don't know, I'm not buying it, God. You can send somebody else, not me. Then God gets a little smoked, okay? He goes, and then the anger of the Lord was kindled against Moses, and he said, you can almost see God taking a deep breath. Okay, is there not Aaron, your brother, the Levite? And God is saying, okay, I know that he can speak well. Behold, he is coming out to meet you, and when he sees you, he will be glad in his heart. He's coming out to meet you for the first time after 40 years you've been gone. Wow, look at this in verse 15. You shall speak to him and put the words in his mouth. Okay, Moses, I'm going to let you use Aaron as your buddy in this, your crutch. Okay, if you're not going to trust me, then I'm going to let you use Aaron here a little bit. And I'll put words in his mouth, and I will be with your mouth and with his mouth, and I will teach you both what to do. He shall speak for you to the people, and he shall be your mouth, and you shall be as God to him. You will be the one I use to communicate it through and to Aaron. Wow. He's still giving him responsibility. Verse 17. And take in your hand the staff which you shall do with which you shall do the signs. God gave him a staff to remind him that it's not you, Moses, who's doing this. It's me. I'm going to use a staff as you go and do this so that you remember it is me who is working. Because God is the one who is at work. Seems to me when we come to this issue of the infirm, that it's not an easy question or easy issue. If you want to go on YouTube, you can see video after video after video of disabled people who have done amazing things. Amazing. People that we would discount and say, oh my gosh, let's just see if we can keep you in an institution. There are so many who have done so many amazing things. There's a guy who, I was watching this video several times. He was born without arms or legs. His arms only went to right above his elbows. And his legs went to right above his knees. And he climbed Mount Kilimanjaro. He couldn't even see in front of him because he couldn't get his head up. So he just basically looked down the entire time and then stopped, would look around. And he climbed Mount Kilimanjaro. It's unbelievable. There's another guy who climbed the same mountain. I don't know why they do Kilimanjaro. But the whole bottom of his, bottom half of his body's gone. From here up, he exists. And he climbed this mountain. You know, guys, there are so many stories of disabled people who have done such amazing things. It's stunning. Now, does that mean that every disabled person can climb Mount Kilimanjaro? No, it doesn't. Some simply, and if you go to nursing homes today or wherever, who simply almost cannot speak a word, but they still have value as human beings. Yes, they can't play Major League Baseball, but how many of us can? They can't do certain things, but it doesn't matter as to their value. I want to show you a video, one that I found this week. It's by about a gal named Karen. And the story is clear, and you'll see the point. And I think it's a point we need to internalize. So I want you to listen to Karen about her story.
First Samuel 16:7 says, "For man looketh on the outward appearance, but the Lord looketh on the heart." I grew up in Dallas, Texas, living with my parents and my three younger brothers. I am blessed that I was raised by godly parents who took me to church from the time I was a baby. They taught me about God at home, too, and encouraged me to learn my Sunday school memory verses every week. I was born in April of 1975 with a condition known as Golden Horse Syndrome. It affects people in different ways, but it causes craniofacial deformities. In my case, I was born without a right ear, lung, or thumb. In addition, I am missing some of the bones on the right side of my face, including my right jawbone. I was born with a cleft lip and a cleft palate. I was also born with a hole between the top two chambers of the heart. Sometimes it still hurts to be different. It hurts when people laugh at me or make fun of me. Many people are unsure of how to treat me and may feel uncomfortable around me. Sometimes we tend to think that just because people may look differently on the outside, then they must be different on the inside. I'm just as guilty of this as anyone else. However, I think that if we would all take the opportunity to get to know people as they are, we would discover that human nature and emotions are pretty much the same for everyone. For example, my everyday life is much like anyone's. I get up every morning and I go to work. I have errands to run. I enjoy traveling and reading, visiting with my family and friends. Some people think that they need to walk on ice around me and never laugh or have fun with me. But I'm a real person, just like everyone else. I'm very happy as the person that I am. I'm not ashamed because I know that God created me and that He loves me just the way I am. I try to be thankful for all the things He has given me. We tend to take things for granted, myself included. But the last thing I want from other people is pity because I know that I'm important to God.
You know, since the time that that was filmed, Karen has had to have a permanent tracheotomy installed, which will prevent her from speaking for the rest of her life. She loves to talk, she says. But her value as a human being has never changed. It's not diminished by this. The disabled, it's only on the outside, right? It's not of the heart. And I think we forget that. And so there's just something about it that we forget. It's uncomfortable sometimes. At the wedding last night of the Romans, there was a boy, I think, had cerebral palsy. It was helpful for me to have thought about this week, because to be able to look at him and say, there is someone made in the image of God. Wow. My dad is a baseball coach, and when he coached at a high school level, one of the guys who was the managers for the team was a guy named Davey Shum. And Davey had cerebral palsy, and pretty severely. He could ride a bike, a three-wheeled bike, but my dad loved having him as a manager on his team. And Davey was just the greatest guy, had this great outlook on life. I could never hardly hear or understand a word he said, but you could see it in the smile on his face, and just such a joy. They're just incredible things. And so you think, okay, God, what would you have us do as your people with the infirm? And I have five thoughts here. First of all, this is that we need to affirm the imago Dei in each and every person, the image of God. We have to affirm that in each and every person. I think that's profoundly important. No matter what we can produce in life, right? Of course, it doesn't matter. That we affirm the image of God. Secondly, that we would do this, that we would find and value the work of God in each person's situation. That we would value what he's doing. It's not always maybe evident to us what exactly he's doing. We know what we'd like him to do, you know, but to really affirm and value what God is doing. When I was when Diane and I were working at the University of Southern California, one of the students involved in our ministry was a guy named Kevin Lewis. And Kevin, when we got there, he had, during high school as a wrestler, had broken his neck. And he had broken it so high that the only muscles that he had to control whatsoever were simply the muscles in the front of his arms. He couldn't control the muscles in the back of his arms or anything below there. So he's wheelchair-bound and had limited, not totally, you know, he could do a lot of things. And we had a lot of fun. And he taught me a lot about being disabled. And so one day he calls and he says, "Hey, Kevin, let's go to a Dodgers game." And I'm like, "Okay." I go, "But I don't have tickets." He goes, "I have tickets. And they're in the disabled section." I said, "Well, Kevin, I'm not disabled, and this is going to be very embarrassing." He said, "That's okay. You can go in my wheelchair." And and I'm like, "Okay, you know, what do you mean?" And he goes, "I want you to see what it's like to be in a wheelchair." And so we got to the stadium. It was awesome. We got to park really close. And we got out, and for only a few people who saw me get out able-bodied and then get into a wheelchair and put a blanket over my legs, for only a few people, they were kind of looking at me like I was a knucklehead. But for most everybody in the stadium, they didn't know. It was such an education for me. For some, I became totally invisible. For others, they were so profoundly rude, I was shocked. I was shocked that they didn't care. They just treated you like trash. I never saw it before. I didn't know that that's what Kevin went through. And for others, they were so helpful. They just go out of your way to help. And I was just, it was such an education to me. Later that year, he and I went to a conference at the Rose Bowl together. It was called America for Jesus Conference, and there were 50,000 people in the Rose Bowl, and there were a variety of speakers, including Dr. Bright, who was the president of Campus Crusade, and he'd asked us to be there, and so we were there, and Kevin went with me on this thing, and because Kevin's in a wheelchair, he couldn't be up in the stands, and so we had to be down on the field. And after the speakers were over, we were down in the field, and Dr. Bright came over, and we were talking, and while Dr. Bright and I were talking, I looked over, and Kevin was surrounded by a couple of hundred people. And there was a pastor in front of Kevin holding his hands, healing him or going through some sort of a healing deal. Now, healings happen, right? They do. So, but he's standing in front of Kevin and he's beginning to say, you know, God is going to heal you. Now, just so you know, there is nothing in the world that Kevin wanted more than to be healed. There is nothing in the world he would prefer than to get out of that stinking wheelchair and walk. He was so tired of that, not being able to have a bowel movement by himself. It was demeaning and hurtful. He hated it. And so he was like, "Heal me," you know? He was like, "Go for it." And so, and I thought, "Oh my gosh, what's this going to be?" And so there are hundreds of people all around him. And so I squeezed through the crowd and kind of worked my way up to the front. And this guy was saying, "You're going to walk and you'll be healed." And he begins to pull Kevin out of his wheelchair. And I'm sitting there going, oh my gosh, what's going to happen here? You know? And then he pulled Kevin out, and Kevin simply slumped to the floor of the Rose Bowl. And what happened there was just like this. It was just quiet. And then this pastor, ill-informed or ill-willed, said, your faith is not enough. It is your fault. And I stepped in and said, it's over. Move on. And I had to put Kevin back in his chair. Kevin is brokenhearted. He wanted to walk. And I don't blame him. Of course, obviously. But Kevin then had to wrestle over the rest of his life, still today. Okay, God, what is the work that you want to do in my life? What are you going to do, even up in this chair? God, this wasn't a surprise to you that I have broke my neck. This wasn't a shock to you that I'm paralyzed. It is not beyond your ability to deal with my paralysis. It is not beyond your ability to deal with the brokenness in my life. God, how will you use it? Now, Kevin, like any red-blooded American guy, would be thinking, okay, who's going to marry this? And sure enough, God brought this woman into his life. And they've been married now for probably 25 years. Lives in the Seattle area. Incredible guy. And has come to grips with what God is doing. Does he still want to be healed? You betcha. He would love to be healed. But he has also kind of found and valued the work that God is doing in him, in the way he's used him, even in that chair, to honor God and glorify God. It's not easy, right, for the disabled and the infirm. It's hard. But God is at work, and God can. Now, I'm not saying, hey, and that makes it easy. I'm saying it's hard. It's difficult. It's painful. But each and every person has value. We need to find that value, the work of God in each person's life. Okay? Third, here's what I'd like you to wrestle with. Wrestle with the reality that God's perfect will has been marred, that his permissive will can be uncomfortable, but also that his ultimate will has profound meaning about how he can use broken people and to take broken things and do something of value. And that's true for all of us, right? It's not just the infirm. That's us too. Maybe on the outside, my body looks somewhat abled, but on the inside, I'm broken too. I'm messed up. I got stuff. God wants to use me. And he wants to use me to grow and learn, respond to him. Wow. We got to wrestle with that reality. Fourth, what mud would God like to use in our lives to heal our infirmities? What's the mud in our lives that Jesus spit into the mud and he made this and he put it on his eyes? God is using some mud in our lives too. What is the mud that he's using? Sometimes we don't recognize it or we don't like what he's doing, but he's using things to heal us and to deal with the infirmities of us. What mud is he using in your life? What mud are you going to let him use in your life to deal with the stuff of your heart and in their hearts? And then the last question is this. Who would God like to use as an Aaron in ours and others' disabilities? You know, remember when Moses, he allowed Aaron to come alongside and be his mouthpiece? Are there some people who errands in your life that God's bringing alongside you? Or would you maybe be an errand in someone else's life? Maybe someone with a disability, someone with a struggle and a hurt? Wouldn't it be incredible if the churches of West County, the churches of St. Louis, we led the way in caring for the infirm, for the handicapped, with the disabled, with the hurting, the disenfranchised, the homeless, the needy, the sick. Wouldn't it be amazing if we're the ones, who cares if it's Democrats or Republicans? Who really cares? But we would care for people. We would love people, deeply love people, even those who are in the shadows of life. Man, what an incredible calling. Will we get written up in a newspaper? Probably not. Who cares? Doesn't matter. It's how do we care for people? How do we love them? I think that's what he's called for us, is to care for the infirm. Jesus did. Jesus touched this man. It wasn't his parents' fault or his. It was the fact that God would be glorified and be able to do the works of God. And that God is in charge. He's in control. He can work all things together for good for those who love him and are called according to his purpose. That's an amazing thought. So even today, Karen, if she still struggles with her disability, and it's getting worse, but that she found God in the midst of it, and that we can too. So let's pray to that end, that God would use us as his people. Father, we do not have a heart to eliminate the disabled, but sometimes they disappear from our sight, or we don't know really how to deal. Father, help us to see their humanity, just their simple humanness, their value, their beauty as to who they are. Help us to love. Call us to whatever you want us to do. With those in the shadows of life in this culture, and that we would bring them into the light. We would let them to live fully and honored lives. Father, change us, direct us, make us the kind of people you want us to be, and even maybe especially and uniquely in the area of the infirm, the disabled, the hurting, the sick, the homeless, the needy. Those who feel totally disenfranchised in this culture. May we reject the stupidity that we so easily can get to. May we embrace the way you see life, the way you see people, no matter what their condition. Would you move us in that direction? And Father, we do that because you've loved all of us. As broken as we are, you have loved us deeply. You've never stopped. You've never forgotten. You've never become ignorant of us. You've always known us. And you always respond with your great love to draw us to yourself. And so you do that for every human being. And we thank you for that.